From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Rules for how universities handle sexual assault allegations might dramatically change. The U.S. Department of Education is reportedly considering requiring schools to allow those accused to better defend themselves against discipline. Off-campus offenses would also no longer be a university's responsibility. We'll debate the proposed changes right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCalGas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Our entire hour focused on controversial court cases in higher education. Later, we'll take a look at class action suit against Stanford for allegedly discriminating against students with mental health challenges. Also, the Justice Department announced today it's supporting the class action discrimination lawsuit against Harvard by Asian American groups. So if you're invited to be on the board of a university, you might want to rethink that given all the lawsuits that are flying around. But we begin by focusing on a New York Times report of a draft of proposed changes that the U.S. Department of Education is seeking for not just American colleges and universities, but the entire education system, K through 12, as well. The changes would apply to how cases of alleged sexual assault and alleged sexual harassment are dealt with at universities. And they include a number of different issues. One of them is about how colleges choose the process by which cases are adjudicated, where someone alleges a sexual assault, either on or off campus. But the other aspect is that it would relieve colleges and universities of the burden of having to make a decision about an event that happened off campus. Joining us to talk about the draft proposal, which the U.S. Department of Education sent a statement to us, says we are in the midst of a deliberative process. Any information the New York Times claims to have is premature and speculative, and therefore we have no comment. But it's been very clear that the Department of Education has been looking at changes to these rules under Title IX. In fact, earlier on, the department sent out a rescission of Obama-era policies about how these cases would be dealt with. With me from Stanford University, professor of law and sociology, she also helped revise Stanford's policy on sexual assault, Michelle Landis-Dauber. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What are your concerns about at least what is proposed in this draft?
Well, this is basically the university lawyers' wish list. University lawyers and men's rights advocates are probably ecstatic with this draft because this is everything that both of those groups want. It would basically gut Title IX protections for students from kindergarten through college.
And so when you say cut the protections, you don't think there's any way for a college or university to be able to take disciplinary action against someone who's assaulted a student?
Well, that remains to be seen, whether colleges and universities will be able to continue to do what they have been doing under the Obama administration. Some of these changes may be permissive, that is, schools can do less, but they may do more, and some of them may be mandatory, supposedly for the protection of the rights of the accused, but in reality, aimed at relieving schools of, responsibility or taking away rights from victims.
Given the lawsuits which have succeeded, filed by some individuals who have been disciplined or expelled from schools, is it possible that even if the Obama administration, continued to this day, they might be looking at revisions just because of the legal exposure that colleges have found themselves with?
No. Actually, most of those lawsuits have not been successful. I mean, they've met with really mixed success. Schools and universities have a wide degree of latitude from a constitutional perspective in terms of how they handle, student discipline. I mean, it's not endless. You have to give students, that discretion isn't endless. You have to give accused students, and you should give accused students, a fair process in which they have actual full notice of what they've been charged with and a fair and full opportunity to be heard in an impartial forum before they could be disciplined. But within those broad guidelines, courts have been very deferential. So let me just say what I think is the worst thing in here, and maybe that can get us started. The worst thing in here is that students will have the ability to cross-examine directly each other in this process. And we used to have that at Stanford, and the net result of having that is that victims will not report. They will not go through a process in which they are exposed to the risk that the person who allegedly sexually assaulted them gets to directly question them in front of a panel or in any other way. Now, there are lots of less intrusive ways that you can allow the accused student to examine the evidence and to ask questions about the evidence that's being presented, such as asking their questions through a neutral third-party member of the panel. But allowing that accused sexual assailant to directly question the alleged victim is outrageous and shameful, and more importantly, will drop reporting to rock bottom.
Well, but in the court system, obviously someone who's accused of sexual assault, that individual's attorney has the right to cross-examine, correct? So why should that level of due process be less when someone's college career is at stake?
Because, well, there's a lot of good reasons. First of all, as Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is, known to point out, when someone is facing college discipline, they're not going to jail. Their liberty is not impacted. And we do give higher degrees of support and due process rights to individuals who are criminally charged. These aren't criminal hearings, and no one's going to jail. So that's first. Second, as you pointed out, it is the attorney, not the accused themselves, who's doing the cross-examining in that criminal context. And then last, I would just say very, very few cases actually end up in the criminal system, and that's one of the reasons. Colleges and universities have an obligation, a duty, to protect the college environment and to take action in order to keep all of their students safe. And when a college has a report and has a reason to know that an individual has engaged in conduct that is dangerous to other students, whether that conduct is sexual assault or arson or some other form of violence or racism, racist violence or anti-gay violence, whatever it is, that college or university has an obligation to immediately intervene and ensure that the environment is safe. And this will tie the hands of colleges and make it impossible for them to provide a safe learning environment.
And you don't think that colleges have the ability to provide sufficient support for an accuser to be able to withstand cross-examination or be willing to endure it?
Based on our experience at Stanford and the experience of which I am aware around the country, this will lead to very, very, very low rates of utilization of any process that includes it. The other thing that's different about criminal cases, if I may just return to that, is criminal trials have a whole set of rules of evidence, including rape shield rules about what can be asked and under what circumstances, and an elaborate system of evidence objections that just don't exist in the college environment. These college hearings, I think even alleged perpetrator advocates would agree with me, often are free-for-alls and rules-free environments. And so allowing an alleged perpetrator to just directly ask questions in an environment with no rules of evidence, no rape shield rules, no, bars on what they can ask at all about past sexual behavior.
You're worried it would just be, it could be a blitz against the accuser with all kinds of accusations and claims made.
In many cases, by the person who raped her. And we have to remember that, many, if not most, of these allegations are going to be accurate, right? So, you're talking about rape victims being cross-examined in at least some cases by the person who actually raped them with basically no rules.
We're talking with Stanford University law professor, sociologist Michelle Landis-Dauber. Also with us, Los Angeles-based private defense attorney Mark Hathaway. He's represented a number of students accused of sexual misconduct. Mr. Hathaway, good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. And good morning, Professor Dauber.
Do you want to respond to Professor Dauber's claims, first of all, that this is going to have a serious effect on victims being willing to come forward and to seek justice?
I disagree with that assessment. I think the new rules have been expected for almost a year now, so clearly the Department of Education has taken its time. We'll know when we actually see the rules and the public has a chance to comment on it. But regarding questioning of a complainant in a college setting, that's required under California law now. In a case that just came down against Claremont McKenna College just a few weeks ago, where the credibility of the accusation is an issue, then the respondent or the accused has to have the opportunity to be able to question the accusation and the accuser. There's just no way to get around that and still provide some form of fair process under California law or due process. And college rules already have in place the same types of protections against asking questions about past sexual conduct or sexual conduct with other individuals. So I don't think that's an issue. It's going to arise in any setting.
Well, how would you enforce that, though? You've got, you know, the students are amateurs. They're not lawyers. How would you enforce that in that cross-examination process that there aren't all kinds of claims made by the alleged perpetrator?
Well, Stanford's process allows for indirect questioning of the complainant in their hearing, and they're one of the few universities that actually has a hearing. In most college campuses in California, the University of California, the California State University system covering almost a million students, there's no hearing at all. It's one individual investigator does the investigation, makes up the makes the findings. They act as the judge, jury, police, all in one. And so those rules are enforced now. The questions can be asked indirectly.
All right. And what about the claim from Professor Dauber that this is really about limiting the liability of universities, not about serving the interest of those whose safety has been severely compromised on campus and that this is going to make students less safe?
Well, if the focus of universities and colleges should be on education, not on policing. You know, at the same time, they need to take reasonable steps to protect their students and make sure there's a safe environment for everyone. But, you know, closer coordination with law enforcement, with the existing criminal justice system, with the existing civil court system that allows for restraining orders and other orders that would protect students should be done before imposing on colleges and universities the role that's generally safe for police. And one point is that most colleges do have two sets of justice, one for the arson, racism, anti-gay violence, for cheating, for every other misconduct. And then there's a completely separate set of rules for sexual misconduct. And I think what the Department of Education wants to see is that there's one set of justice that works for everybody.
Professor Dauber, what about in this draft, according to the New York Times, the colleges would not be responsible for acts alleged to have occurred off campus if they're not, you know, college-sanctioned events? Your thoughts on that?
Yes, I think that is the second most egregious proposal that the Trump administration is making here, because it exempts the majority of all sexual harassment that occurs in the school context, and importantly would exclude faculty, the vast majority of faculty harassment of students, because most faculty who sexually harass students don't do it in their office or on campus. They do it at parties at their home or at someone else's home and at conferences that are away from school. For example, Jeffrey Marcy, the astronomer from University of California, Berkeley, you know, was found to have harassed women at conferences. So fraternity houses are often not at Stanford, they're on campus, but often they're off campus, away sporting events. I think what's really going to happen is that it's going to create a lot of uncertainty and a lot of litigation around the question of what is a school program or activity.
Yeah, because to me, a conference, if you've got a professor and a student going to a conference, I don't think of that as just, you know, some unrelated event. That's very directly related to the educational mission of the school. That wouldn't be covered?
It will be the subject of litigation, would be my guess, about whether that that particular conference under those particular facts and whether what they were meeting about at the time was social, personal, professional, or school-related. You could have a narrow interpretation of it in one circuit of the federal courts, and you could have a broad interpretation of it in another circuit of the federal courts, which would also lend unfairness and uncertainty to the insurance environment. I mean, I think this is a disastrous proposal because if you just take the case of peer assault, which is the one everyone is thinking of, even though I'm suggesting to you that we think about, you know, this is a K, you know, 16 or K for, you know, kindergarten to college scenario, so we need to think more broadly about what they're doing here and include faculty harassment. But if you just take, you know, pure sexual assault, you know, if this is sexual assault occurs in a fraternity house off campus, but then the two students have to be together in an activity or class on campus, that's no less traumatizing for the victim than it had occurred on campus. So this is a nonsense rule that is simply a get-out-of-jail-free
okay.
for colleges and universities and fraternities.
I need to wrap. Professor Dauber, thank you for being with us. She helped revise Stanford's policy on sexual assault. She's professor of both law and sociology at Stanford. And Mark Hathaway, a private defense attorney, quick response to the point that, particularly when it comes with fraternities or conferences, this could set up a very bad situation when those folks return to campus?
I don't think that will happen at all. Those clearly are school-related activities. What this will prevent is situations like happened at UC Berkeley recently where a student had sex with someone in China and the school was trying to punish them for that, things that are completely off the campus and unrelated to the school.
That's all right.
This is expected to stop.
Mark Hathaway, defense attorney who's represented students and others accused of sexual misconduct, his practice based in Los Angeles. Coming up, a look at the Justice Department siding with Asian American organizations who filed a class action lawsuit against Harvard over what the group say are its discriminatory admissions policies. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. This entire hour focused on the law and education. And then in our second hour, KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes give us the very latest on the dispute over salary and other aspects of the contract between LA teachers and the district. That's coming up in our second hour. Right now, though, we turn our attention to another dispute in higher education, this involving Harvard University, where class action lawsuit by a number of Asian American organizations have sued Harvard, claiming discrimination in admissions and what's essentially, they allege, a de facto cap on the number of Asian American students who are accepted to Harvard. With us, Melissa Korn, Wall Street Journal reporter, who can share with us the very latest development. Melissa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we learned today that the U.S. Justice Department is weighing in, siding with the plaintiffs in this case. What does that mean?
Sure. So this morning, the Department of Justice filed what's called a Statement of Interest supporting the plaintiffs, which is a nonprofit group called Students for Fair Admissions. And the Justice Department is saying that they agree with what the plaintiffs are saying, that Harvard puts Asian American applicants at a disadvantage with their use of a personal rating as part of the admissions process. They say that they unfairly give Asian American applicants a lower personal rating. They limit the number of Asian American students it admits and hold them to a higher standard than students of other races. So those are all allegations that the plaintiffs made and that the Justice Department today is saying that it backs. It thinks that those allegations are legitimate.
Does it appear that the action by the federal government is in direct response to the Harvard internal documents which were released a few weeks ago?
So there's a lot of disagreement over how important those internal documents are. It's according to Harvard, it was a draft, very preliminary report using partial data on admitted or on applicants and admitted students from the Office of Institutional Research. So they say it was really a preliminary partial report and that they never pursued it because it was incomplete and they acknowledged it as much. The plaintiffs say that it is the smoking gun that Harvard then buried. So it depends which side you ask in terms of the role of those documents.
And what, as a practical matter, does justice's involvement, does that mean that legal staffing goes to support the plaintiffs or just that it makes a judge aware that the federal government holds to the view of the plaintiffs? What's the practical importance of this?
So it's not going to change the outcome of the case, just that the Justice Department has said has filed this statement of interest. It's not going to sway the judge one way or another. There have been a number of court filings by organizations, Asian American organizations, other minority groups, lawyers, sociologists, economists on both sides of the case. So this Justice Department filing is one of probably a few dozen. It does, however, indicate the Justice Department's real focus on race-based affirmative action here. They had opened their own investigation into Harvard admissions last year, and similar claims about Asian American applicants, but not the same exact case. So they have a very clear interest in whatever the outcome is for this case. They also, this summer, repealed guidelines from the Obama administration on how schools should consider race in pursuing a diverse student body. So they have put affirmative action in the crosshairs, and this is kind of just the next way that they're staking out their territory.
Melissa, thank you so much. Appreciate your joining us today.
Thank you.
She covers higher education for the Wall Street Journal, reporter Melissa Korn. Also with us, Hans von Spakovsky, who's senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and he's the former counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice in the early aughts. Sir, thank you for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You see this as a positive for the plaintiffs here, that this will be helpful to have the Justice Department on their side?
Yeah, I think it is positive. Now, it shouldn't be a surprise because, in fact, in this case, the Justice Department previously made some filings back when Harvard was trying to prevent the plaintiffs from actually getting access to their Harvard's admissions data and policies and procedures. The Justice Department actually came in and said that the plaintiffs were entitled to that kind of information. Harvard, throughout the 4 years of the discovery process, has been fighting, trying to prevent the plaintiffs from getting any kind of access to its admissions data.
Well, and their claim has been this is proprietary and that they're working in a much larger pool of other elite universities using their criteria as well. So, but the judge did not side with Harvard on that claim, did it?
No, it didn't, although it's interesting. If you look at the motions for summary judgment that have been filed by the plaintiffs, it's almost like looking at one of those documents, the government puts out when they redact classified materials. There are large areas of the motion for summary judgment that have been blacked out, because there is some data that, although the plaintiffs have been entitled to it, the judge has still said it can't be public yet.
We're talking with Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation, formerly of the Justice Department. Also with us, Brenda Shum, who's with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She directs the Educational Opportunities Project there at the committee. Ms. Shum, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you, your group filed an amicus brief on behalf of the defendant's motion for summary judgment that was just referred to. Are you disappointed or concerned about Justice this morning announcing its weighing in?
As an initial matter, the Lawyers Committee represents a group, a diverse, racially diverse group of applicants, current students and alumni at Harvard. And these students are African-American, Latino, Native American, and Asian. And I think that the decision by the Department of Justice to file a statement of interest today really just ends weeks of speculation about what their ultimate intention is in terms of both this specific litigation and, as was already previewed, the federal government's position regarding affirmative action in higher education. And we believe that Harvard's race-conscious admissions process is entirely consistent with over 40 years of legal precedent that affirms the ability of colleges and universities to pursue the educational benefits of diversity as long as it's done in a narrowly tailored way. So we believe that this move by the Department of Justice reveals an unprecedented suspicion regarding the benefits of racially and ethnically diverse institutions, and more importantly, the position that the Department of Justice took in filing this statement of interest really ignores the record, which suggests that there is no racial preference against Asian American applicants, and at most, any bias that might be revealed in terms of Harvard's application, admission system is probably more attributable to the preference for athletes, children of staff and alumni and the like, sort of what the university would refer to as special admits, and those special admits heavily favor white applicants. The only other thing that I would clarify in terms of the Department of Justice's statement of interest is that it really supports, it was filed in opposition to Harvard's motion for summary judgment, and really is just an indication that there is sufficient factual dispute for this case to go to a full trial.
And you think that's pretty much a done deal? This is going to be litigated in court?
We believe that this is going to be litigated, and it is set for trial beginning in mid-October.
Do you think that it is going to be particularly challenging for Harvard to defend on that issue of the personal assessments, which, at least according to the plaintiffs here, disadvantage Asian American applicants?
We believe that both the plaintiffs in this case, as well as the Department of Justice, have filed papers which reveal that they do not fully understand the admission process at Harvard, as well as the admission process for college applicants more generally. And I would concede the earlier point that the number of redacted documents in this case makes it complicated. I mean, quite frankly, I think that Harvard's decision to assert the confidentiality of some of its practices is heightening the anxiety around the admission process at that institution. But the fact is that the personal rating or the personal assessment that so many people seem obsessed with does not actually include a specific consideration of race in terms of specific score. It could allow for a student to discuss their racial or ethnic background in terms of the personal essays that are a part of that bucket of criteria.
As students often do.
It's entirely voluntary. So some students, in fact, choose to speak how race and ethnicity has informed their identity. And for other students, including students of color, this is not sort of the most defining aspect of what they believe they could bring to Harvard's campus in terms of diversity.
We're talking with Brenda Shum, Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Hans von Spakovsky, your response.
There's a lot of problems with what Brenda just said. Harvard's own internal report, the one that they buried and did everything they could to prevent becoming public, shows that, look, right now, the Asian American admission rate at Harvard has stayed steady at about 19%. Their own internal report showed that if admissions were based purely on academics, Asian Americans would make up over 43%. If you took into account the university's preference for athletes and legacy admissions, which was earlier admitted, they would make up 31% of the admissions process. Asian Americans score highly in all the different factors that Harvard takes into, except for the personal rating. And by that's when admissions officers basically give a character assessment. And that is what's used to basically block Asian Americans from getting in. But you can tell there is there's stereotyping of Asian Americans and discrimination going on by the fact that there are actually two personal ratings done. One is done by the admissions office, and it is consistently low by the admissions office. But there are also personal ratings given by Harvard alumni. You know, these are the people, former Harvard out across the country, that also interview prospective.
I need to break.
And the personal ratings of those Harvard alumni are very high. It's clear that Harvard is using the personal rating to hold down the number of Asian Americans coming in. Look,
I need to break there. I'm so sorry. I'm right up against the clock. My thanks to Hans Van Spakovsky, Brenda Shum with us. Share your comments. Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back right after a live update from Eddie Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. It's sort of coincidental, just all this fascinating education news that's out. Our entire first hour devoted to higher ed, then coming up in the second hour, KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes with me. He's going to lay out the complexities of the dispute between the LA Unified School District and its teachers, United Teacher Los Angeles, the union, which is taking its strike authorization vote this week. But right now, we close out the hour with a focus on a class action lawsuit against Stanford. It accuses the university of discriminating against students with mental health challenges by forcing them to take leaves of absence. New York Times report says this part of a larger pushback from students against leave of absence policies, which they claim can jeopardize the student's academic career, further damage their mental health, and might prevent a student from seeking help in the first place. A university can ask a student to leave if he or she presents a harm to others, but less clear what a university can or should do if the student might harm him or herself. In some cases, a leave of absence gives a student opportunity to get away, get some mental health treatment, then come back, hopefully in a better state of mind, but others say that's often not what happens. With us, licensed psychologist, VP for Student Affairs at Pepperdine University, Connie Horton. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Obviously, this is a challenge for universities and colleges to determine the best way to deal with a specific mental health challenge that a student has. How ideally, in your view, do universities walk this line?
You're right. It is a very difficult balance. On one hand, we so want our students to be safe and well, and of course that needs to be a number one priority. But we don't want to violate rights. We don't want to discriminate in any kind of way. And so in my experience, it's often best to work very frankly and honestly with the student, and in some cases their families, to help them come up with a voluntary plan that makes sense.
And in your experience working with students, if you've had one who's come to you with a serious mental health challenge, are there times that there's been a conflict? The student wants to stay, and you believe it's really in the student's best interest, not just the institution, that there's some time away.
Yes, sometimes that's especially how it starts initially. But I find often that if we're able to connect well with the student, and again, in some cases with the family, to make sure they know that we care about them, that we care about their safety, but also that we care about their academics. So, for example, if we can reassure them that their place is held at the university, that there'll be no discipline record, and if we can remove financial disincentives, like if we can say we'll credit what you paid for tuition in the following semester, that helps them to take a leave if they need to. But not all students need to take a leave. Some students can stay and can get additional care. Maybe the crisis has resolved. Maybe they're on medications now. Maybe there's reason to believe it's likely to be different, and so they're able to stay.
The ex-Stanford student profiled in this New York Times piece that's just out, the student Harrison Fowler laid out that, you know, he felt he should have been allowed to stay, and that Stanford really should have taken it upon itself to do all the treatment that he needed while he continued to be a student. I know you can't speak to his individual case because you don't have any of the specifics there, but what are the potential challenges in providing that sort of therapy, you know, maybe daily therapy, or can universities do that?
Yeah, at some point the resources and the level of expertise or specialized treatment may be beyond what a university can do. Sometimes we liken it to at the health center for physical health problems. You can have a very comprehensive health center, but they're not going to do heart surgery, for example. So on the mental health side, yes, for a time they might be able to do extra sessions and make sure they have priority getting in to see the psychiatrist and so on. But if somebody really does need, for example, to be hospitalized or at least intensive outpatient therapy, that may be more than what a university can provide.
We're talking with Connie Horton of Pepperdine University, Vice President for Student Affairs, also a clinical psychologist and former director of Pepperdine's Counseling Center, and also at Illinois Wesleyan University. I welcome your calls on this. If you're a mental health professional, you've worked with a population of students at colleges or universities, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. If you, when you were in college, had a mental health challenge where you were in a deep depression or maybe even suicidal, you had need for some serious intervention, how did the college or university handle it? And what do you wish they would have done if they did something different than what you felt you needed? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me is Daniel Collegier, who is a partner with Trigstad Schwab and Trigstad, based in Los Angeles. The firm works on employment law and represents educational institutions. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Larry. And actually, just to clarify, our firm is education and employment lawyers, but we generally do not represent the institutions. We're usually on the student side of, or the educator side of things. But of course, we're familiar with both sides of the coin, you might say.
Okay. You said, so it's generally the professor or the student you represent. Okay, yeah. Got it.
And sometimes administrators, but usually it's
the... But not the school. Okay. In a case like this, what is alleged here is not only that the school interfered, that Stanford interfered in the educational opportunity of the student, but that in essentially sending him to an off-campus facility and saying, you know, this is where he needs to go, that then he claims he was given the wrong meds and, you know, all kinds of things that sort of cascaded in his view from this. What potential legal liability do schools have?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, obviously complicated, but you know, this student was as I understand it, was an undergrad, although which has some potentially different implications. You know, graduate students sometimes have an employment responsibility sometimes concurrent with their education, so that does add another dimension to it. But just taking students in general, the universities, even private universities, are subject to federal and state law concerning disability rights. A mental disability or mental condition can be a disability. And as such, it is critical and legally required for the university to engage typically in an interactive process to see if those disabilities can be accommodated in some fashion. Leave is sometimes an accommodation, certainly, and maybe an appropriate one under certain circumstances. But it's not something that, in my view, the university should unilaterally dictate, unless obviously there's certain obvious, objective threats or conditions that, can't leave that student on campus.
One of the challenges for the institutions is that they can't really specifically respond because of privacy laws. So as we continue, we'll talk about the ways in which a university, in this case Stanford, might defend itself in this lawsuit. We're talking with attorney Daniel Kolodze. Also with us is Connie Horton of Pepperdine University. And again, I'd like to hear from you if you're a mental health professional who's worked with population in higher education, if you're someone who has firsthand experience with this, perhaps a mental health challenge led you to take some time away from school, your thoughts about pros and cons of that. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up in our second hour, a segment that we had to reschedule. I was so looking forward to it. We were going to do it earlier this week, and then with the passing of Senator John McCain, we needed to take significant time to talk about his legacy and his death. So today, in our second hour, we're going to take on this issue of if you are an immigrant or child of immigrants, how did you decide whether to use an anglicized name or not? Were you concerned that people might mispronounce the name that you were given by your parents, which would correlate with the culture that you've come from? Did your parents want to give you a name they perceived as American, that people would pronounce, that they would think of you as American, so therefore it's an English language name? We're going to talk about that in the second hour and find out whether you changed it anywhere along the way, going one way or the other, toward or away from an anglicized name. That's coming up second hour of Air Talk here on KPCC. Right now, our focus is on a class action lawsuit against Stanford University accusing the school of discriminating against students with mental health challenges by forcing some of them to take leaves of absence. Now, according to the New York Times story on this class action lawsuit, Stanford's website says a leave for a student may be encouraged or required for a student whose psychiatric, psychological, or medical condition, quote, jeopardizes the life or safety of self or others, or whose actions significantly disrupt the activities of the university community. But, of course, there's a lot of gray area in there as well. Connie Horton, if a student comes to the counseling center on campus and that student talks about potentially, self-harm, how does the mental health professional determine how far to go in the treatment of that and whether the student needs to go into a residential facility?
Yes, and it's so important, as you mentioned, that be an individualized assessment, so not something like a zero tolerance or a one-size-fits-all, but really to sort out what does that mean. A lot of students, unfortunately, have seriously considered suicide and may even have suicidal thoughts currently, but that doesn't mean that they're in imminent danger for themselves or certainly that they're going to hurt anyone else. So a psychologist at the counseling center will assess those kinds of things. Is there imminent risk? Are they, obviously, they're at some level open to treatment. How open to treatment are they? What care have they had before, et cetera? So they need to do it very individualized, and it's going to be held confidentially unless there is viewed to be some kind of imminent danger or if they release their records. if they believe the student is going to hurt themselves imminently, then they would need to take a mental health plan first and sort out the status with the university later. So, for example, if the student needs to go to the hospital or if the student signs a release so the parents can get involved in the conversation, the priority at the counseling center would be the mental health care. And then a secondary concern later would be what is the status with the university.
In this lawsuit, the claim is of the students that they were effectively banished from the university when they were put on leave, that they were stripped of their privacy and autonomy, their own doctors second-guessed by the universities, and the students required to immediately withdraw from all classes, programs, and housing. To return to campus, they had to write personal statements accepting blame for their behavior. Obviously, you can't speak to the specifics here, but Connie Horton, when you hear a description like that, what do you think?
That seems surprising, I'll put it that way. I think certainly that would not be the experience here at the university where I work. It would be an individualized assessment. It would be highly, highly unusual that there would even be an involuntary leave, because almost always an alternative plan would be enacted that's voluntary on their part, and their caregivers help them make a decision that's good for them. There is a time, though, when somebody is not safe, of course, to be on campus or could be dangerous to someone else, that university threat assessment teams, for example, could say for this season, the student is not allowed to be on campus. And usually if somebody is on a leave, they typically are encouraged to stay in their treatment plan, and they don't need to be on campus. And if there's questions about safety, they don't need to be going back and forth. But the harshness of that is especially concerning.
How do you you have a student who presents with deep depression, expresses wanting to do self-harm, but the student wants to continue to stay in school, even as she or he might be talking about the pressures of school, relational issues that might come up in the counseling process. Do you ever have to make the decision, look, I know you want to continue in your classes and school activities. You can't. You must get help right now. Does that ever happen?
Highly unusual, because usually the psychologist is able to say, to work with them to come to their own conclusion. Is this working for you? Is this getting better? How important it is to prioritize your safety, and this doesn't seem to be working. But again, it would depend on the level of self-harm. For example, some students will cut themselves on occasion with no suicidal intent. A student may be able to be in school with counseling for some season of that behavior, even though it's concerning and alarming to people who care about them. It isn't necessarily they're going to take immediate action to kill themselves. But if somebody's safety imminently was in question, then a different plan need to be.
Do you ever contact parents without the permission of the student in an extreme circumstance, or does the law forbid you from doing that unless the student signs off?
It depends on which hat we are talking about. At the counseling center, it would need to be viewed as an imminent, assuming the student is over 18, it would need to be imminent danger. But then, yes, they could make an exception. In my current role as vice president on the student affairs side, if there was a mental health crisis, and particularly if the student is a tax dependent, we have some leeway in the FERPA guidelines to let parents know. Again, usually we want to keep developmental perspective, help these emerging adults be young adults, and help facilitate conversations with their parents rather than doing it for them. But sometimes we have needed to do it for them.
All right. Thank you so much, Connie Horton. I really appreciate your talking with us. Valuable information. Pepperdine University VP for Student Affairs. My thanks to Daniel Colige, who is a partner in an LA firm that works with students, educators, and others. Great to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. though you didn't have enough. Education matters on today's show. It's all education. Ed Talk today on Air Talk. A little bit later this hour, though, we are going to do something different. We'll talk about President Trump's claim that Google rigs the search results of news to disfavor conservative news outlets. And we'll take a look at anglicized names. If you're a child of immigrants or an immigrant yourself to the U.S., how have you decided if you've had the option of using a name that is popular in the culture that you come from versus a name that the majority of Americans might be able to better pronounce, or it might be more common in this country? That's coming up on Air Talk here on 89.3 KPECC. But right now, we take a look at LA Unified, where the impasse continues over a new contract between United Teachers Los Angeles, the union, and the district. Joining me is KPECC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, good morning.
Good to be with you, Larry.
So today, the deadline for UTLA member teachers to vote on a potential strike authorization. Tomorrow we'll know, and the assumption is teachers will authorize a strike.
Yeah, it looks like a pretty much a done deal at this point. A lot of people feel like this is going to be an overwhelming vote in support of a strike. And this has been going on for the past week here. It's kind of been one of the events that has been part of an escalation that's happened mostly over this past summer. Things kind of kicked off in July after kind of some torpor in the negotiations. The union kind of walked away. They declared impasse. They actually declared impasse twice. And after one last shot at negotiating back in July, they said, we're done. We don't think any more unmediated talks is going to result in a deal. And so the teachers union walked away from the table, called in for the help of a state mediator, and began immediately to move toward this strike vote, which has been a part of the second or third week of school here in Los Angeles Unified.
And let's talk salary first. What kind of an increase is UTLA looking for?
Yeah, and this has been one of those issues that there hasn't been much movement from either side. They still remain pretty far apart on. UTLA is looking for now a 6.5% increase, and over the entirety of this negotiation, which has been almost a year and a half, they've been pretty staunch on that number. They started at 7% and just recently came down to a 6.5% across the board increase. Compare that to the district. They're offering a 2% increase in across the board salaries. They, for a long time, were offering no, increase in base salaries. And in fact, we're just offering a bonus for a long time. Only recently came up to a 2% increase. They're now offering 2% plus a bonus of another 2% and then a classroom supply stipend. So we're talking 2 or 4% versus 6.5%. And both sides are pretty dug in on those numbers.
And I can hear the arguments on both sides from the district standpoint. Look, inflation hasn't gone up 6.5%. And I can hear the teachers saying, yeah, but rents and housing prices to live in Southern California has gone through the roof recently.
Yeah, can we live near the schools that we're teaching in?
But it's not even in Los Angeles.
Exactly. And it's not just salaries, though. And I think this is an important point to make, because the costliest items, according to the district's calculations, are actually not the salary increase. That would cost in the ballpark of about $200 million to get what the teachers wanted versus what the district wants, according to the district's calculations. Again, the things that are actually more expensive are a teacher asked to put a harder cap on class sizes, teacher asks to increase the number of counselors and school nurses. They want a school nurse in every school. They want a librarian in every middle and high school. These are the proposals that actually, if you add all of those up, that's about four times more than the cost of the salary increase that they're asking for. And that is also part of the stick in the mud negotiations, because that's what the teachers want just as much as the salary increase.
How much has state funding increased for LAUSD in recent years?
It's increased a lot in recent years, but this is an issue. The state funding now has leveled off. The governor had, about 5 years ago now, implemented a new state funding formula called the LCFF, the local control funding formula.
Ago?
I know. know. Seems like just yesterday. And it's been such a present issue for school districts in rolling this out. But anyway, the governor recently declared through the most recent state budget that the formula was fully funded for the first time. So school districts cannot count on the kind of systemic increases in funding that LAUSD says it has used in recent years to make up for the fact that enrollment was declining.
And these were funds largely pegged to challenges in student achievement, disadvantaged households, and so districts like LA Unified, with a high percentage of more challenging home environments for their students, disproportionately benefited from those state funds.
Right. I mean, these are funds that it was just as much about funding based on the needs of students as much as freeing up districts to spend this money how they wanted. This is a whole separate fight. I think the bottom line in the union negotiation context is that the state is not coming in with another increase as they have been systematically doing for the past couple of years. And there may be one-time money in the future. The district has used one-time infusions of cash, couple hundred million here or there from the state to patch holes in its budget. The district can't budget for the next 3 years or for the life of this contract agreement on the hope that one-time funds are going to help them balance the budget. That's what they say.
What is the union's response to this about how the district would absorb the ongoing costs talked about with all the personnel? You talked about the librarian in every right. middle and high school and additional counselors and all, because those are permanent hires. So how does UTLA say the district would pay for that?
Well, so LAUSD right now has, this is technically speaking true, they have $1.7 billion in reserves right now. And the union says we should have access to that money. We should be having, that money to pay for these asks that we're looking for. The thing that line from the union kind of it leaves the misleading impression that money is just a big pile of cash that the district is sitting on and refusing to spend, when in fact the district says we need to spend that $1.7 billion over the next 3 years in order to make sure that we end each of those next 3 years in the black. They have plans to spend that money. They are going to burn through that money in order to stay in the black. And part of their plans
for
to
spend— current obligations.
For current obligations and for— they've budgeted in as part of their plans to spend that $1.7 billion. You can see it in their most recent budget documents, the exact amount of money that they expect salaries to increase as a result of labor negotiations, not just with teachers, but with salary agreements that they've recently signed with other unions,
classified
the principals and employees. Classified employees. Yeah. So, it's both true to say that there's $1.7 billion in reserves, but the district also has a point when they say we're using these reserves to balance a budget that is becoming increasingly unsustainable. And that is the clash of ideologies that's defining this negotiation.
Kyle, how do you think the personalities play into this? Because any labor negotiation
yes.
is not just the issues. It's the people that represent each side. Austin Buettner, the new superintendent of LA Unified.
Yes.
I think it's safe to say many UTLA members don't trust him.
Yes.
Believe he's looking to create more charters in the district. And then you've got Alex Caputo-Pearl, president of UTLA, and the district, of course, has some issues with him. So how do you,
right.
How do they factor into this?
Well, this has played out in recent, kind of weeks as this kind of feud has heated up. A couple of weeks ago, Austin Buettner sent out a letter that was basically like after Caputo-Pearl and he had a private meeting. Caputo-Pearl says he was there to talk about why the district was dragging its feet about going into negotiations. But Buettner sent out a letter that was like, thanks for having a really great meeting. We really appreciate you sitting down. And he also kind of basically dangled a deal out there, saying, this is a way that we could possibly settle this. Caputo-Pearl came back and said, that is absolutely deceitful. That is not what we talked about. This did not come up. And that has played out, kind of back and forth. The district recently filed an unfair labor practice complaint against the union saying basically you've never wanted a deal all along. You're actually angling for a strike. This does kind of go to your question about personalities here. Buettner has taken a much tougher line than superintendents in the past on in terms of being a fiscal hawk, in terms of trying to get LAUSD's fiscal house in order. On the other hand, Alex Caputo-Pearl and UTLA leadership have been angling. They've been talking about strike readiness for a long time. They've been talking about creating or capitalizing upon a moment of crisis. And when they say that, they're saying they're trying to say, you know, we need to fund public education. We need to make it, you know, ultimately clear to state lawmakers that it's important to fund this stuff well. But the personality clash that you mentioned, Larry, is absolutely going on here. The two sides don't trust each other. And I think each other sees political benefit in sparring with the other side.
KPCC K-12 reporter, education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, how does the student population factor into this? Because we've got a long-term trend, part of which is housing prices here, a fewer kids in LA Unified. And I'm talking even separate from charter school creation. Just the student population's declining. LA Unified several years ago opened all these new campuses. Are they going to have to at some point look, to because of the financial challenges you're talking about, at closing campuses as the student population further declines?
I think this is one of those questions that kind of comes up at the margins, but there are huge – I mean, you're mentioning a lot of a confluence of factors that is causing the current budget crisis. I think, you know, there are absolutely people out there who would say that closing campuses is part of the option, or at least studying how, you know, the campus are managed. But you're mentioning the enrollment decline. I mean, the district has
part of the issue.
It is totally part of the issue. You're absolutely right. And the district has been losing, thousands of students every single year. In fact, this year, the district opened up with less than 500,000 students in the district run schools in its boundaries for the first time in decades at this point. There has been nothing that the district has tried in the last 20 years or so to reverse this enrollment decline that has worked. At the end of the day, we can talk about, you know, healthcare costs or any of the other factors that are in the budget, but school districts build their budgets around enrollment. Enrollment is declining. So that is, I mean, the question really has arisen. Like, has the district adjusted to the new facts of life in a smaller district with smaller enrollment numbers?
And it seems like almost every public district in Los Angeles, certainly in coastal areas, dealing with this because of the high cost of housing, making it very difficult for families to afford to live in those areas. Let's talk with Daphne in Westwood. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling from a parent's perspective whose kids do go to LAUSD, and currently my son is going to be applying for college. And with a strike that is looming above us, we are so concerned with letters of recommendations and all the other sorts of stuff that is for his future so important. But what people don't understand is that the students, more than anyone else, are going to suffer. They're kids who count on the lunches, count on the day-to-day kind of a place to go and sort of getting educated and not hanging out on the streets. I mean, there's so many other issues that are so much more important to the kids, and none of this is being discussed by anyone. It's going to cause a much bigger problem and concern for the district.
Are you steeling yourself for the likelihood of a strike, or do you believe ultimately they'll be able to reach a deal in mediation?
I think if the current labor leader would take up the offers that was being placed by maybe the governor, I mean,
Mayor Garcetti
to kind of sit down with him and, you know, have an outside person, then that would mean that they want to have a negotiation, maybe have a mediation. But he's declined that offer as well. So if you're declining to even sit with the mayor who, you know, is trying to find a way to resolve it, and they're already planning a strike without mediation being scheduled, how could you not even go into mediation and already decide that you're going to strike?
Daphne, I appreciate your call and providing a parent's perspective. So, Kyle, the mediation is scheduled for late September, right?
That's right. And even
this is the state mediation.
That's right. Yeah, the state mediator. It's part of this whole dispute resolution process that has to take place before the union can legally strike. The first mediation date has been set for late September. Even the fact of that date is onerous to the union. They feel like the district is dragging their feet in that. The district has said, we're basically taking the date that the state mediator said that they can meet. So it's you know, even that has become a political football. But that kicks off a process that takes weeks, months. It goes through a mediation process, then goes ultimately perhaps to a fact finder if there's still no agreement. That's months. And until that process is completed, the district or the union cannot legally strike.
Mayor Garcetti, as Daphne just said, made this offer to try and broker some sort of a deal between the union and the district. Is that even possible when state mediation is already scheduled?
Well, I think that the even bigger question is whether the teachers union is interested in it. I mean, in the past, Mayor Garcetti has gotten involved, and this is what he cited as part of the reason that he said I could get involved here is during the port strike with the ILWU walkouts across West Coast ports. You know, Mayor Garcetti, you know, was part of the, you know, sort of got involved in trying to help settle the dispute. The union has said before this offer ever come up that they are very leery of meeting outside of the formal process because, according to the president, what he told me in an interview, that when you go outside the process, that's when things can get kind of fast and loose.
Hey, Kyle, thanks so much. Boy, the time has flown by. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's very complicated and, as always, done a great job of explaining the complexities and nuances of the labor dispute. Thank you.
Thank you.
KPCC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes with us laying out where we stand today. The deadline for the vote on campuses, UTLA members, whether they authorize the strike. But as Kyle said, any actual strike, even if the authorization vote is affirmative, would be months down the road. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk today. I'm Larry Mantle. Sure enjoyed talking all these education issues, but time for a change of pace now. Let's talk about search results. President Trump certainly has been lately in a series of tweets accusing Google and other U.S. tech companies of rigging search results about him so that, as he tweeted, almost all stories and news is bad, capital B-A-D. The top advisor says the White House is taking a look at whether Google should face federal regulation over search results. This came from a Pajamas Media piece about putting in Trump news and having what the Pajamas Media writer said was largely liberal news organization search results rising to the top, and those with a more conservative take being much lower in the results. We're going to talk about that with Joe Balestrino, who is a consultant and independent search engine optimization expert. He's author of The Definitive Guide to Local Search. Joe, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Briefly describe for us how search results take place. What are the factors when Google has an entry there that brings up particular results?
Well, Google looks at a bunch of different metrics in order to decide, first of all, what website should rank in Google for certain terms. So for news organizations, it usually comes down to who's linking to the content, what they're saying when they link to the content, and how people interact with the content. So, for example, if there's a news story that breaks, not always, but sometimes the first one to put out the story starts getting the most engagement. And as the engagement starts going on and other people start sharing the content, the more that Google sees this as a signal as this is something that interests people. Now, there's other things that can influence that, such as, you know, if you have a site that has technical issues and you push out a story just trying to get out quickly, Google doesn't crawl it. And it doesn't get published. Or on the other hand, you can have you try to rush to put out a story very quickly and it's too short and Google deems it not newsworthy or not enough length in order to rank the content.
Joe Balestrino with us, search engine optimization expert, also with us from San Diego State University, lecturer in management information system. Stephen Andres, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Political bias is the allegation here. Is it possible that in the algorithms that search providers like Google use, that political bias can be introduced into that process?
Well, certainly it's a black box, so anything's possible. Whether it's probable is a better question. And to presuppose that they would have some algorithm that ranks results based on political leaning that pleases the heads of Google assumes that someone is out there hiring thousands of political scientists to categorize these websites and probably categorize each article on the website based on a scale of, on the political spectrum. And then the question is, which political spectrum scale do you use? It's very unlikely that this is happening.
If it's based on reliability, I put that in quotation marks, I wonder, though, if that might be creating the same kind of result, because historically, what's considered to be reliable purveyors of news would be organizations like the New York Times, like major American television networks, the Los Angeles Times, other publications that have been highly critical of President Trump. And I think a fair number of Americans would say have a left of center orientation. So I'm wondering if it's not that Google is sort of, you know, actively trying to put liberal content up to the fore, but just what is sort of historically considered to be reliable mainstream news media has, you know, taken on in some cases an anti-Trump bent.
I think you've hit on it. And let's also recall that, you know, newspapers and sites such as Washington Post, New York Times, when they get something wrong, they'll print a correction. A lot of Americans are now turning towards alternative sets of news sources like a blog or maybe Facebook. And those are less likely to correct or have some sort of editorial standards that they stick by. And certainly that is probably informed in the Google search algorithm. We don't know it on looking from the outside in. But absolutely, you've hit on that it's just a factor. Also, in this study that wasn't scientific at all, Trump News was kind of a broad statement. And if you search for it now, of course, the news is about the controversy about the news. Kind of a snake eating itself.
The meta level of this. The other issue I was going to raise, and curious your thoughts, is just the sheer volume. And I read a lot of conservative media because that, like liberal media that I consume, is part of preparing to do my job. But just the volume that comes out of, say, a New York Times compared to a Daily Caller, it's a huge difference. And so I wonder if part of this is just, you know, the sheer number of stories we're talking about.
That could be an indicator as well. Certainly your other guests can speak to that more expertly than I can. But obviously the volume of a news publication is an indicator that one might use to indicate quality. And quality is always going to be subjective. But Google has the advantage of machine learning, which is a fancy word for artificial intelligence. So they can present you a bunch of results. And if you don't like those results and go to the second page, they've taken in that input and they said, these results might not be the good ones. So they're constantly tweaking things. And we've got to remember that Google search engine isn't like your Yellow Pages where, you know, everybody has the same page 46. It might be different for you as somebody searching from New York, definitely different if somebody's searching from Australia. So it's a little bit difficult to take these unscientific surveys, two data points from two conservative bloggers, and extrapolate that to be, 96% of the search results are left-leaning.
Well, it's funny because I have, when I do searches for politically oriented stuff, I have quite a few conservative sites come up, perhaps because that's in my history of having clicked on and gone to a lot of conservative sites for preparation. So, Joe Balestrino, can you speak to both those points that sort of, if his web search history informs customized results, first of all?
Yeah, absolutely. So whenever you're signed into Google and you're signed into your account and you do searches, Google kind of starts collecting that data and tries to show you stuff that you've seen before and know that you're going to engage with. So that certainly makes sense. And then usually as a professional myself, when I do certain types of searches, I usually go incognito so that that history isn't there, so I'm not getting customized results to my search history.
Ah, that's interesting. I'd love to hear listener comments on this. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. If you want to weigh in on this, share your thoughts about it. And Joe Balestrina, also your thoughts on the volume of news created by so-called mainstream media. I don't know what other term, but sort of the heritage news organizations. And is that going to advantage them automatically?
Well, it's funny. When you talk to people who aren't in my industry, we know that there's a lot that goes behind the scenes. There's a lot of technical issues and problems that could happen with these sites, which is part of what I do for a living, is to help solve these technical issues. But the volume certainly does play into account if you're pumping out more stories. As long as there's quality and Google sees that there's trust there that's been built over time, then, absolutely, that can actually play a major role. But also, when you do searches and you see those little search boxes come up, if you type to President Trump tweets and you saw three or four different listings there, there's things that publishers can do that kind of skew you to click them one way or the other. Either the headlines are a little bit more flashy, or the images are not flattering, or kind of tell a different story. That can also skew the way things go in Google's algorithm.
We're talking with Joe Balestrina, author of The Definitive Guide to Local Search. He's an independent search engine optimization expert. Do you have any advice for conservative news sites on how to get higher ranking results?
It's hard to say. It's just about putting out quality content as soon as you can, as unique as you can, and try to keep headlines specific to search. In my industry, we keep Google titles different than social media titles, because social media, you don't have to really worry about keywords. And when it comes to search engine results, people are typing in specific keywords to get certain results. So to make sure that they're on target with the keywords that people would, in their mind, would think they would use to search to find this kind of topic. And that will help them, at least to get the traffic.
Stephen Andre of San Diego State University, you mentioned being a black box, that, sort of the algorithms that are used by search. How do you make that more transparent, or is there any way, or is this just so proprietary, there's no way you're going to get Google or another search engine to share more specifics how they get their results?
So part of it is certainly intellectual property. We wouldn't expect Coca-Cola to give up their formula. But it's also a bit to think that these are rules written in English that say, pluck these results. A lot of it is machine learning, and honestly, they don't know how the machine picks it. That's a scary thought. But you give the machine a bunch of examples, and you tell it to learn, and you tell it what makes a good result, what makes a bad result. And it is opaque to all humans how it's making that determination. So when you hear Congress says, well, we want to know how you're choosing these things, they can honestly say, we don't have these written rules. It is this algorithm that's continuously learning. That's unsettling to people, because we want there to be some truth at the end. But it's actually more efficient for this machine learning to make millions of calculations a day. And I wanted to follow on to what your other guest said. A smaller conservative blog probably doesn't have the resources to hire an SEO expert, versus Washington Post probably has a staff of 10 that can do that SEO optimization.
And when we look at other search engines beyond Google, I know it's dominant in the market, but Microsoft's Bing product, Yahoo, are there distinct differences that you're able to discern, Stephen?
I'm certainly not the expert on the different search engines, but I would say there are differences based on usage, right? So the search engines depend on our searches to improve their results. So obviously the kind of unfair part of this is the dominant search engine, Google, is going to have more results, more relevant results, because they have so many more inputs from the rest of us. Bing and Yahoo, they're kind of at a disadvantage because they don't have that many inputs. So they can do their best, but they don't have the input there.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both so much for being with us. San Diego State lecturer Stephen Andre and Joe Balestrino, author of The Definitive Guide to Local Search. You can share your comments about President Trump, his comments that Google rigs search results to disadvantage conservative perspectives and conservative sources for information. AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming right up, I want to hear from you if you are an immigrant or a child or grandchild of immigrants. How have you decided whether to use a name that would come from your family background, from the country of origin, or an anglicized name that might be known to a broader cross-section of America, might be easier for people to pronounce, but maybe you wouldn't feel as connected to your family's culture? How did you make that decision? 866-893-KPECC. Back after a live update from Hetty. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Last week, Star Wars actress Kelly Marie Tran wrote about the kinds of abuse she'd been getting on her Instagram account, people making reference like Ching Chong and harassing her over her Vietnamese-American ethnicity. So she closed down the Instagram account, deleted her old posts. But she brought up in her writing about this another really important issue, and that is that she decided, instead of using her American name or anglicized name, she was going to use the name that was given to her by her Vietnamese parents and one that is more common in her family's culture, Loan or Loan. I'm not sure how it's pronounced, which I guess underscores what we're talking about in this segment, L-O-A-N. But that she's going to use that because it's an affirmation of her culture and her enjoyment of her Vietnamese-American ethnicity and what that culture represents to her. Well, this started a whole conversation among our producers in our meeting. Everybody had all kinds of interesting stories to share since I've been talking about us doing this segment. I've just had so many people. In fact, our editors' meeting for the whole station had a whole conversation that came out of this. So let's bring it to air. If you're someone who is an immigrant or a child or grandchild of immigrants to this country, and you have had a name that is common in the culture of origin, or an Americanized, anglicized name, I'd be interested in hearing how you've decided which to use. Have you, like Kelly Marie Tran, decided to go to a birth name that you feel is more connected to your culture, even if people have a hard time understanding it, or you have to spell it out to them, it's more work for you, but you feel it's worth it, or the opposite? 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, or Leanne Sherman Oaks. Welcome.
Hi. I find this a very interesting topic. Obviously, it speaks to both origin and identity. My parents came here from Israel several decades ago, and mine is an Israeli name. It means my light in Hebrew. And my last name is Frank. So from the time I was enrolled in school here, my name was reversed. I was enrolled in boys' PE classes.
Oh, no.
I to this day, have basically assumed that everyone is going to address me as Mr. Frank Orley. It's misspelled and mispronounced constantly. But my parents, both of whom are European, gave me a middle name, Grace, which is obviously Anglican, and just now, at this point in my life, at middle age, I'm starting to use that name. And I actually find it interesting that I'm doing that because I avoided it my whole life. I really can't even say what has...
Yeah, I was going to ask why you would do that when you've been Orly your whole life.
I actually don't know. I think it's just that I'm tired of explaining my name. I'm tired of explaining its origin. I'm tired of the response. I'm tired of spelling it. It's just Grace is just so much easier. And I think that there's also an element of that name that I just identify with more now that I've been here for as long as I've been here.
Yeah. Orly, I really appreciate your call. Thanks. Good start to our conversation. Orly in Sherman Oaks, 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Jean in Diamond Bar, share with us how this has played out in your life.
So I'm a little lucky in that my name is Jean. And my Chinese name is actually Su Zijing. So phonetically,
close.
It sounds very similar. In fact, my last name is Su, so it's like inverted. So I consider myself lucky because I really have no struggle with whether, you know, I'm using my Chinese name or English name. However, I would say that if my name wasn't Jean and didn't sound like my Chinese name, I may consider, I'm in my 30s now, I may consider actually, you know, going back to that. But, you know, to echo the other caller, I see what she's saying about, you know, as an immigrant, sometimes we just want to be accepted. We don't want that experience of being questioned over every little thing. We just, you know, want to be able to be part of everything.
Well, and it's a good point you raised. So there are multiple slices of this, of layers. There's the sort of the feeling of belonging that I think you're getting to, being as American as everyone else. There's also the issue of just a hassle if you have to, you know, constantly spell your name or people, oh, what does that mean? Or and then they start asking about your family background. I can understand where that would be a hassle, too. But the other side of that, of course, is that, you know, this is something if your parents particularly gave you a name that connects to your culture, that's got to be hard to leave behind.
Yeah, and that's why I consider myself very lucky. One last comment I want to mention is I came in the 80s and 90s we were kind of the Taiwanese wave of Chinese immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I work with a lot of Chinese immigrants coming from China. Students in particular. And I have noticed that the 80s wave, and, you know, a lot of it has to do with the political relationships between Taiwan and America at the time. Almost all of us anglicized our names coming over, whether it sounded like our Chinese name or not.
Yeah.
While I'm noticing a lot of the more recent Chinese immigrants coming, there are some that anglicize their name, but a lot of them just, you know, keep the It's just, you know, they translate it phonetically.
Hey, Gene, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much. It's funny, our senior producer, Fiona Ng, she said that she gets asked all the time, oh, what's your Chinese name? And she said, well, actually, my family's from Hong Kong. And, you know, given its British, its history, Fiona is my given. That is the name that I was given by my parents. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Nick in Hollywood, welcome. How have you dealt with having a Greek versus an English name?
Well, you know, it was very sad, Larry, because they came over in 1912, and the last name should have been Kustandaros. And immediately they were given the name Constance. And there were five children. I'm first-generation American. There were five children in my mother's family. They were even given not their real birthdays. So my mom actually celebrated two birthdays, one given at Ellis Island in about 1915, and the other one that we knew was her real birthday. So not only the real family name, but also not the real birthday, which is very, very sad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so if you felt that there's something culturally lost in making those more commonly American names.
Absolutely. I mean, it just wipes away your heritage and your culture and the name to be proud of. And all of a sudden, you're just out of the air, a name is pulled out of the air, and that's who you're going to be. And I think out of fear and probably not wanting to make waves way back when, we're talking about 1915, they were happy to be in America. They never questioned or wanted to go back to the real name.
Yeah, Nick, I appreciate it. And so often, as you're describing, immigration officials in this country would just change people's names, either because, you know, they didn't know what they were or to make them more, quote unquote, American. Nick, thank you so much. I love pronouncing Greek. It's like Italian names. I love how they roll off the tongue. They're very enjoyable to say. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, KPECC. KPCC.org. Roy messaged us on Facebook. He said, my full name is Rogelio, but I just go by Roy. After years of school teachers destroying it, I just decided not to use Rogelio. I also feel it looks better on applications, too. All right, you can share your thoughts at 866-893-KPECC. How have you decided whether to use a name that is connected to your racial or ethnic background or country of origin, or a name that's more commonly used in the U.S.? And have you ever gone back and forth? 866-893-KPECC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're talking about names, whether you're an immigrant or child or grandchild of immigrants, and whether your name has at all been something you've wrestled over, whether it's keeping a name which is originally from the country where you or your family came from, but maybe is hard for the majority of people in this country to pronounce, or they can't figure out how to spell it. So for practical reasons, maybe you've changed your name. Maybe you at one point had an anglicized name and you gave that up. You wanted to connect more with your family background and you went to a name that you knew you'd have to explain. You felt that was well worth it. I'd like to hear your story at 866-893-KPECC. Amina writes on the page, I'm Lebanese. I have a cousin who calls himself Jay, but his real name is Jihad. You can probably guess why he changed it, but I still think of him as Jihad and I have to bite my tongue sometimes not to let it slip out in public. That's Amina joining us on the Air Talk page. Let's talk with Paz in Hacienda Heights. Welcome.
Oh, hello. My name is Paz, and I am from Mexico. I came here as a little girl, and the name Paz means peace. It's spelled P-A-Z. Growing up with that name was quite challenging because in the 70s, little girls weren't named Paz. So I got teased a lot in middle school, in elementary school. People would joke and say, Paz for a moment, or Paz attraction, or Pazzy Wazzy was a bear, Pazzy Wazzy had no hair. So I heard it all.
Yeah, yeah.
So in my 20s, I became a nurse, and I was introduced to the real world, and I changed it. It was easier to just go by Maria. Everybody was named Maria. And even though it's still Latino, and it was just easier. Most of the people that know me as a nurse call me Maria to this day. But all my elementary and high school friends call me Paz.
Did it help? I think there's an actor, if I'm not mistaken, Paz Vega, to have, you know, someone who's been in some movies. Does that help at all? If
it
there's
now, and I embrace it now, I'm proud of it now. But yes, you're right. And when that started to be seen, it was easier to. It didn't sound as strange. Also, I learned later that some Filipinos are named. Named like myself.
Well, and so in nursing, that would give you a number of colleagues who would have
A lot had to do with embracing it myself, not so much the people. It was my own in feeling like I was strange, I was different.
Yeah.
Apologizing for my name. So then later on in my 40s and 50s, now I'm 50, and I feel comfortable being Paz. I even ask the people who know me as Maria to please now call me Paz.
That's great. Hey, Paz, thank you for talking about that story and your evolution of using your name and the professional change of name that you went through. Paz in Hacienda Heights. Quentin messaged Air Talk on Facebook. I'm a first-generation Chinese immigrant, and I opted to give my son both the Chinese and English first name. Even for me as a native Chinese speaker, Chinese names can be confusing when I work in China. Jackie Chan would not have become a household name if they marketed him with his Chinese name, Cheng Long, which is ironically a stage name. So that's Quentin messaging us on our Air Talk Facebook page. Speaking of actors, Alex in Long Beach, I understand you're an acting professional. So did you change your name?
I did. And it was more a question of my agent suggesting it. You know, my birth name is Fernando. And growing up in the 70s as a child actor, it was fine when I was trying out for Hispanic shows. When we tried to get me into American-type auditions for American shows or commercials, they would always frown when they would see the name Fernando, expecting me to have like a Hispanic accent or anything in that nature. So my agent suggested, let's change it to something else. So I was a big fan of Family Ties. So I go, I'm going to be Alex. And so I picked that name. And it was my family had a problem with it, but we had an uncle named Alejandro, which is similar to like Alex in American culture. So I kept that for 27 years. As we've moved forward in television and diversity and seen a fluctuation in shows like, Fresh Off the Boat, Black-ish, you see a lot of more diversity. My new agent has suggested for me to change my name to something Hispanic.
How funny.
To Fernando.
Are you going to do that? Go back to your birth name?
I'm actually, at 27 years now, I've had my name as Alex, and I'm used to that. When I tell people my birth name, Fernando, they kind of squint at you and say, I just can't picture you as a Fernando. I'm so used to you having an Alex. But professionally, I'm thinking of going back because there's more need now with the Hispanic and Latino community growing that there's more need for me now. Being Hispanic.
All right. Hey, Alex, thank you for sharing this story. And yeah, isn't that interesting how the industry has changed so much and the potentially a Spanish first name would be beneficial. Alex in Long Beach with us. Amelia writes on the page, I am of Spanish descent. My parents chose a name that is in my family. I'm often called Emily by other Hispanics, including some family members. I notice many second and third generation Hispanics have or give their children's English names, Joseph rather than Jose, for example, often misspelled and mispronounced by Anglos, but it's never crossed my mind to accommodate my name to their phonetic palate. That's Amelia writing on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Norma writes on the page, my sister has a Welsh name that people destroy, though, funnily enough, everyone in Hawaii get it because they just pronounce it phonetically, and now my sister likes it. That's Norma in Lakewood. Let's talk with Svetlana in Pasadena. Welcome.
Hi, Larry. I'm Svetlana, and I come from Belarus. I came here about 10 years ago, and I actually never considered changing my first name to accommodate people even when they couldn't pronounce it. I think partially because I came here in my late 20s, and I really associate strongly with my name, but partially because I take it as a chance to educate people both about my culture and about my country and my heritage. So I actually choose the inconvenience of taking some extra time to explain rather than accommodate to diversity of this country and this region.
Svetlana, thank you so much. Love that story. Let me share some others as we're short on time. Ms. Kindness in Chino Hills says, I'm an African-American. I was named, it's one word, Ms. Kindness, M-S, kindness. It was difficult for me growing up, but in adulthood, I own my name. Black people typically understand why my dad gave me that name. There is a cultural aspect because of ethnicity. That's Ms. Kindness in Chino Hills. Hamish in Long Beach says, my name is very difficult to pronounce, but I don't want to avoid using it because my parents gave it to me. It affects me in business because people don't know how to say my name or are intimidated by it, but I try to work around it. At Starbucks, though, I use an anglicized name. That's Hamish in Long Beach. These are great stories. This is terrific. Talar in Glendale. I have a very authentic Armenian name. I changed my name to Tall, but my Armenian family will call me Taller. I have a difficult name to pronounce. Had trouble in college. Always had to explain it to everybody. So many other great comments we don't even have time for. Would you please put them on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org? I'll look forward to reading them, and I encourage you to do the same throughout the afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Jake Tapper of CNN and The Late Show, Stephen Colbert, is with Terry coming right up. Have a terrific day.